United States against Bender. Ms. Kister.
May I please the court? Good morning. In the interest of time this morning, and I don't have much, I'm going to confine my remarks to the first claim that I briefed on appeal regarding or pertaining to Mr. Bender, and that is with regard to the claim concerning the right to counsel. And what I'd like to do is address what I identify in the government's brief as three important fallacies. The first is, and the government contends, and I'm sure will contend this morning, that there was no violation under the Sixth Amendment here because Mr. Bender, in fact, never retained this attorney, Mr. Scicchetti, to represent him. And I think that although we have a grossly underdeveloped record in this case, and it's very murky on very many material points, the record is very clear that, in fact, this is what Mr. Bender did. He did retain this attorney. He paid him some $13,000 to represent him.
What difference does that make? The United States says that Scicchetti withdrew of his own accord and then closed his practice completely in light of his impending discipline in Ohio. Is there any dispute about those two propositions?
I would dispute the first one, Your Honor. I don't know that this was of Mr. Scicchetti's.
If you don't dispute the second one, the first one is irrelevant. If Scicchetti closed his practice and was no longer representing litigants, then he wasn't going to be representing this litigant.
But that wasn't the basis, as we know it, for the court's determination in the first instance to disqualify this attorney.
Who cares? If the district judge disqualifies an attorney wrongly and the next day he's run over by a truck, there wouldn't be any basis for reversing the conviction. Because being dead, except on TV shows, he wouldn't be representing the defendant.
And with all due respect, Your Honor, I think that's beside the point. I don't think that's of any consequence. I think
so
the question.
Think we would reverse the conviction if the attorney died the day after a wrongful disqualification.
I would reverse.
You can think that, but it ain't going to happen.
Under Gonzalez-Lopez, Your Honor, I would reverse that conviction because in the first instance, the disqualification was groundless. We didn't know, we don't know, we can't possibly know from this record that there was a conflict of interest here. There's nothing to indicate that, and we don't know that from Mr. Scicchetti himself. We really don't know that from the court. All the court says with regard to the attorney's position in this case is that once upon a time, and we don't know when, he represented a possible potential witness or co-defendant, Robert Lee Johnson. And none of that ever comes to fruition. We don't know that that presented any kind of an actual serious conflict for this attorney.
Was there ever an actual involuntary disqualification order entered by the district court?
I don't know that. What we do know is that Mr. Bender persisted in appealing to this judge that he wanted this attorney, and ultimately the judge said, this isn't going to happen. This attorney is not going to enter his appearance.
Well, you're arguing the case, though, as though there was an affirmative order entered disqualifying this attorney involuntarily, and apparently you're conceding that there wasn't now, or you don't know if there was.
There's no written order in the record.
Is there an oral order in the
there
record?
Seems to be an oral order, or at least a reference by the court that he's not allowing this attorney into the case.
Well, in what terms?
Well, in one of the early proceedings where this is being hashed out, see if I can find it quickly. The court says on page 11 of my appendix, the court says, in this matter, and that would present Mr. Scicchetti with a difficulty in the event that Mr. Johnson was a participant in the trial in some manner and he was representing you at that time. So I'm not going to allow Mr. Scicchetti to represent you because he does have a conflict. Okay, so that issue has been resolved. On what basis? I mean, where's the conflict? We don't know anything about that conflict. And that's why I say that, you know, the remainder, the balance of the record, is grossly underdeveloped with respect to whether there was any conflict ever. But, yes, I think there is an indication here that it's the court that puts the brakes on this. It had been Mr. Scicchetti's indication originally that he was going to enter. He intended to enter. Certainly Mr. Bender wanted him to enter. The court said no, and I think what we have to do is analyze the court's decision in light of what the court knew at the time and not 6 months later when this attorney, in fact, as it turns out, could not have represented this defendant. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Kister. Mr. Groves.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm here on behalf of Tony Johnson, whom I represented in the trial of this matter, and I'm also representing him on this appeal. The only issue that I've raised relates to what I consider the most damaging evidence in any criminal case, especially in conspiracy cases such as the one at bar today. Mr. Johnson was convicted of conspiracy and sentenced to life in prison. The testimony of his co-defendants or co-conspirators was utilized by the government. That testimony would have been great weight placed upon there because obviously they were there, they participated in the crime, and they were the most important witnesses in the case. I've pointed to the emphasis placed upon the testimony of the co-defendants or co-conspirators by the government in its closing arguments, in that their testimony matched up entirely, 100% locked tight. One must then look at why their testimony matched up 100% locked tight. It's Mr. Johnson's position that the fact that the co-conspirators who had already pled guilty and were in the custody of the United States Marshals or the Bureau of Prisons were housed at the Henderson County, Kentucky detention facility in the same jail cell, not just the same jail, but in the same jail cell for a significant period of time prior to and during the course of the trial.
Did the sequestration order go so far as to also order the witnesses to be held separately in the jail?
No, it did not.
So you're not arguing that there was a violation of that order. You're making a different sort of an argument? That the witness who came forward afterward and said that he could testify to being in the same cell with these individuals?
My argument is...
Should have been permitted to testify in a new trial?
It's twofold in that it's a logical extension of the rule for separation of witnesses in trial. Obviously, the basis for the rule of separation of witnesses is that the witnesses don't have the ability to coordinate, corroborate, or discuss their anticipated testimony amongst themselves prior to or during the trial. Generally, I would concede that my witnesses or other witnesses who aren't in custody, it's difficult to control those witnesses outside the doors of the courtroom from discussing or coordinating their testimony. However, this is a specific instance that's important that the government had absolute control over these witnesses, and they were placed in the same jail cell. The information was learned after the trial by a Kentucky State inmate who was also within the same jail cell that reported to my client and then signed an appropriate affidavit that, hey, these fellows were talking about the case. They were coordinating their testimony. They were rehashing the facts of their anticipated testimony in order to probably get consideration from the government. Either the government told these co-conspirators not to discuss the case amongst themselves and they ignored it, or the government did not tell them to not discuss the case amongst themselves. Either way, I believe the testimony was tainted to the extent that a new trial would be necessary and their testimony barred. And I base that not only on my beliefs that the most important evidence in a conspiracy case would be that of the co-conspirators, but also what apparently is the government's belief that, in closing, Mr. Brookman asked the jurors to consider the testimony of all of the co-conspirators, that they matched up perfectly. The series of events that fit exactly with Jesha Fox. Based upon that, in and of itself, the jury could consider. I see I'm out of time. May I finish my thought, Your Honor? The jury could base its conviction solely upon the testimony of the co-conspirators, which was tainted.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Brookman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I am Matt Brookman. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney. I'm in the Evansville office. I was the trial counsel on this case and also handled all the pretrial matters. And I'd like to address the choice of counsel issue first. And I don't want to take a lot of time with it because I agree with the court that ultimately it's a moot issue because Mr. Cicchetti was charged with possession of cocaine himself and disbarred or voluntarily surrendered his license and would not have been a available counsel at trial, even had he wanted to be. But I think to just point of clarity, an answer to your question, Your Honor, there was never a order of involuntary disqualification of Mr. Cicchetti. And what the court said, and I was present for the conference calls with Mr. Cicchetti. There were at least two of those. And what the court told him is that he had reminded him that he had represented Robert Lee Johnson, that there was some evidence that they were co-conspirators in this drug distribution ring between Chicago and Evansville. And I had, of course, informed the court of that, and I had informed Mr. Cicchetti of that. He told Mr. Cicchetti that in his opinion, that could create or did create a conflict. And he asked Mr. Cicchetti to research that and get back to the court and let him know what his position would be on that. Mr. Cicchetti did get back to the court, and it's reflected in the transcript of the hearing from September 22nd, which
is... The next question would be a question addressed to the litigant, which is, if that's a conflict, are you willing to waive it? Was that question ever addressed to him?
That question was never addressed because in the prior to the September 22nd hearing, when Mr. Bender was brought back over, Mr. Cicchetti was contacted again, and he said, you know what, Judge, I'm not going to represent this defendant. Now, David Cicchetti could have gotten back to the court, and of course, again, this is all in theory because he wasn't a competent counsel come trial time anyways, but he could have come back and said, I've talked to my clients, and their positions are not in conflict with each other. The clients could have told them, we don't even know each other. But our defenses are not mutually exclusive. Or just as Your Honor suggested, he could have come back and said, I've talked to my clients, and they both waived the conflict, so I'm cleared to go. And in that situation, I suspect he would have been approved to be the trial counsel. Now, all that would have accomplished ultimately is that we would have gotten to trial, and either A, the defendant would have had a cocaine addict and a disbarred lawyer as his counsel, and we would be back here on a post-conviction relief case, or B, the slightly better situation, we would have ended up with a continuance, and we would have lost another trial date in this case that had been pending for over a year at this time anyways. So, but the ultimately, it was Mr. Cicchetti's decision to withdraw from the case, and only he can know whether he has a conflict or not. He's not required to tell me what his conflict is or whether he has a conflict. Frankly, I don't think he's required to tell the court what his clients have told him and whether he believes he has a conflict. All we know is that he voluntarily got out of the case after being raised the potential of the conflict. That's the record, and if you look to the September 22nd transcript from the pretrial hearing, that's what that record reflects. Now, on the issue of Mr. Johnson with regard to the separation of witnesses order, I would clarify on that also that there was never a violation of the court's order under Federal Rule of Evidence 615. No witnesses were in court at the same time, nor has there ever been any allegation that any witnesses went back after their testimony and told another witness what their testimony was or what they had been asked in court. There's no allegation like that. The allegation is simply that several of the government's cooperating defendant witnesses were housed at the Henderson County Detention Center, at the same detention center. And the court needs to understand, too, that Evansville, we don't have a federal detention center there. We rely on the marshal's contract with the Henderson County, Kentucky jail. And unfortunately, we don't have five or six places where we can put defendants and keep them in separate facilities all over the place. We don't have those kind of resources. So it frequently happens that cooperating witnesses are in the same jail, as well as defendants who are going to trial are sometimes in the same jail.
Was this in the same jail or the same cell?
Well, the setup, as I understand it, Your Honor, is that it's not the same cell. It's a pod-type setup where you have a large room where they can come out, and then they each have jail. They each have a cell where they'll be in a cell together, but when the doors open, everybody's all together. And the same is true with rec. If they go to the gym and play basketball, they're all together.
They must make some effort to separate the cooperating witnesses from those who are standing trial.
They do. They do separate the cooperating witnesses from those who are standing trial. But to separate each cooperating witness individually from them from each other would be a virtual impossibility. And even the trial defendants and the cooperator defendants, they're still able to get messages to each other. Their threats are conveyed. You know, ultimately, what happens in the worst case scenario, if we have to, the cooperator goes into the administrative segregation, and they're there by them. You know, they basically there face solitary confinement.
As I understand it, only three of these five cellmates or pod mates, whatever the appropriate terminology is, actually testified.
That's correct.
And they were subjected, and only one actually had anything to say about Johnson, and they were subjected to cross-examination on their bias in light of whatever deals they had cut with the government, as well as, I assume there's usually cross-examination about who they've discussed their testimony with and that sort of thing.
They were cross-examined extensively, Your Honor, about their plea agreements, about their motivation. They were all very upfront about their motivation. They were examined on direct examination about their motivation. I discussed their motivation in closing argument, and I told the jury to consider that and to be cautious with their testimony because of their motivation. All these things, all of that ground was plowed extensively, and that's why that brings me to my next point, which really is that the Bibbs affidavit information would be at best impeaching material. And cumulative to what was our, and they were already impeached on that at trial. An even bigger point than that, I think, is that the Bibbs affidavit only refers to Vishnu Bender. It doesn't even relate to any information about Tony Johnson or that the cooperating witnesses were saying anything about Tony Johnson. If you look at the Bibbs affidavit, which is in the appellant's supplemental appendix, page 58, it says that these individuals were brought in from a federal prison to testify against a Vishnu Bender. That's in the third paragraph. And again, there was no, contrary to what appellant's counsel claimed, there's nothing in this Bibbs affidavit that says they were coordinating their testimony or that they were rehashing the facts. What they were saying is, if you believe Mr. Bibbs, is that I don't care about Vishnu Bender. I've got to serve 20 years. I'm going to do whatever it takes to get some time off of my sentence. That's a far cry from coordinating their testimony or rehashing the facts. So I don't think that the argument really doesn't hold any water. The sufficiency of the evidence argument that was raised by Mr. Bender is weak also. There were a number of co-defendants who testified to multiple sales over a long period of time, standardized, fronting, the use of runners by Mr. Bender to accomplish his drug dealing. All these things, any one of these things by themselves, as this court has recognized in other opinions, would constitute a basis for him being a part of the conspiracy. And in this case, there were not just one, but there were several bases. So based on all that, I would ask this court to affirm the convictions of these two defendants, and I thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Ms. Kister, Mr. Groves, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment and the assistance you've been to your client in the court. The court is in recess.